The following episode of Bookmark was first broadcast January 14th, 2025. Every day, every day, every day, every day I read the book. Chapter 1, you didn't really get along. Chapter 2, I think I fell in love with you. All right, good afternoon and welcome to Bookmarked, where today the book under discussion is Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. And my guest, whom I'm very happy to welcome back, is Dr. Rebecca Bell-Medero. You want to say hi or something?
Yes, hi. I'm happy to be here again.
Yeah, well, I'm very happy to have you. Dr. Bell-Medero is very recently retired from Texas State University, where she taught film and directed the Interdisciplinary Media Studies Program. She's the author of Hollywood Androgyny and Transgender Cinema, co-author of Simone Weil on Politics, Religion, and Society, and co-author of the wonderfully named Star Bodies and the Erotics of Suffering, which I keep meaning to ask you about. She also, not at all incidentally, serves on the Texas State Board of Education. You want me to add anything about you?
I think that covers the main bases.
Okay. Dr. Atul Gawande, I think that's the right pronunciation, is an American surgeon, a writer, and a public health researcher. He's the author of Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on Imperfect Science, Better, A Surgeon's Notes on Performance, and I think those are essay collections, possibly, since they're notes, The Checklist Manifesto, and this book, which is his best known. He is currently the Assistant Administrator of the United States Agency for International Development. He's founder and chair of Ariadne Labs, a joint center for health systems innovation, and of Lifebox, a nonprofit organization making surgery safer globally. He was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship and the Lewis Thomas Award for writing about science and a lot of other things. He really has a very impressive resume. And an attempt at a sort of an overview. Being Mortal starts with the observation that medicine does a really good job of keeping people alive, but fails to cope with the inevitability of aging and death. His chapters describe the painful consequences of this failure and talk about efforts to remedy it. And in a sense, it's not really two halves, but he does talk first about aging and elder care and then about end of life decisions, so that kind of covers it. He describes research, he profiles people working for change in this area, and he writes openly about his own experience. He includes the stories of a few of his patients, and a friend, his wife's grandmother, and his own father as kind of well-developed running examples. Anything you want to add to a summary?
Well, I would dive right in and say that when I first began reading the book, I recognized all of the things that he had done as being things that I had admired when I was listening to the radio and I would hear a report on the checklist and I would go, oh, that's so important for surgeons to be able to have something that they can go through and check. And then international aid and all of the things that he has done have been so important. And I feel like he's so multi-talented. Yeah. He should run the world.
Yeah, I think I'd be happy to live in a world run by him, particularly because given the way he writes now, I think he might ask me or the rest of us once in a while, you know, what we were experiencing in order to help him run the world better.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And then I like the way he established his own background and how he came from a culture where aging is not as much of a problem because older people tend to live with families. So they have someone there who can kind of keep them part of the family and able to function. And it certainly stands in contrast to what we have with our sort of isolated families and putting people away in care facilities.
Yeah, but I've got, now I'm gonna skip a couple of things, but I'll maybe go back because I want to respond to what you said about that. I noticed that too. It's a beautiful description of his grandfather, who lived to be almost 110 in India, doing exactly what he wanted while being cared for by his extended family that lived with him. And I thought that Gawande was going to hold that up as kind of an ideal, like this is what it should be for everyone. But he does, interestingly, he doesn't say that. He talks about some of he talks about the advantages of that for the aging man, but some disadvantages for the family. They wait to start their own lives until his life is over. And even maybe for the older people who now, he says, as children departed from home for opportunities elsewhere, parents who lived long lives found that they could rent or even sell their land instead of holding it down, and they could go and have fun. And he talks about Del Webb's Sun City places.
Right.
You know, I don't think I want one of those, but you see, you know, Kissing Tree is full of people who seem to be very happy there. So he certainly has a point. And then he goes on to say this. For those who had no interest in moving into such places, it became acceptable and feasible to remain in their own homes, living as they wanted to live. I'm on page 22 if you're looking. That fact remains something to celebrate. There is arguably no better time in history to be old. The lines of power between the generations have been renegotiated, and not in the way it is sometimes believed. The age did not lose status and control so much as share it. Modernization did not demote the elderly. It demoted the family. It gave people, the young and old, a way of life with more liberty and control, including the liberty to be less beholden to other generations. The veneration of elders may be gone, but not because it has been replaced by veneration of youth. It's been replaced by veneration of the independent self.
That was one of the lines that I noticed, and it was interesting to me because I think that although we celebrate this idea of the independent self, it seems that our society has more of a problem with people being lonely, of not being connected, not necessarily dependent, but helping other people and having connection. And I can see that coming from the kind of society that he came from, where there was sort of too much of that, I think that the book kind of romanticizes the independent self.
You know, you could be right about that. I didn't necessarily see it that way, but yeah, and of course he is the son of people who immigrated and began a new life in another place, which not everyone does, and that takes a certain you have to venerate the independent self a little bit to even do that, you know.
Right, and it was also interesting, I thought, the way he presented the variety of issues that come up when people do have problems, where they break a bone or they have some kind of a medical issue. We don't have a good system for handling those kinds of events.
Mm-mm.
And I think that part of it is that we don't have socialized medicine. And
yeah, he doesn't get much into that. But
He does not. That's kind of a.
He's got enough to cover. I had the feeling not that he doesn't care about that, but that's another book, maybe coming up.
Right.
I can't go too much further with this without just saying that this is an absolutely splendid book, and it's not just because of his treatment of the subject matter, which is. Fascinating. I mean, it's fascinating to me. Okay, I'm old now, so yes, of course, I would be interested in this. But the writing, I thought the writing was so good that I almost wanted to spend the whole hour reading the book aloud, you know, just saying, oh, hey, listen to this.
It is. It's wonderful. I found myself laughing out loud when he was talking about Felix Silverstone about being the senior geriatrician at the Parker Jewish Institute. He was saying there's no single common cellular mechanism to the aging process. And then at the end of this whole section, he says, I asked Silverstone whether gerontologists have discerned any particular reproducible pathway to aging. And he said, no, he said, we just fall apart.
Yeah.
That made me laugh out loud.
Yeah. And one, to me, some of the other strengths of the book are there's a balance between personal examples, discussions of research and ideas, and his own analysis that to me works just about, there's not too much of any of that. And another thing, and I mentioned this to you earlier, was that he is willing, I mean, he's this great authority, right? Somebody you would be happy running the world. But he is willing to admit that, oh, I didn't know anything about this, so I talked to this person and I learned, and he or she taught me this or that, you know, and he does that several times throughout. And I thought that endeared him to me, you know, when I read him.
Well, he enters the subject as someone who could be the reader. And so we identify with him. We don't have the sense that he's telling us about something that we don't know about. We have the sense that he's telling us the story of how he learned about this.
Exactly.
And that narrative quality is part of what makes it so delightful.
Yeah. And I did want to say something about graphic. This is the description of aging that had me drawing a little scary face in the margin of my notes. But there are other descriptions further on, which I don't think I'll read, of people's terminally ill people's symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the woman who's got, I think it started as ovarian cancer, but it keeps blocking up her bowel, and, you know, it's just...
I know. If people have difficulty with medical details, they really probably are not going to like this book. But if they used to think they wanted to be a doctor, as I did when I was in high school, I found it all very fascinating.
You just reminded me of my cousin, of whom I'm very fond, who always wanted to be a doctor and never... here's his next Christmas present. Okay, here's the description of... which is not the most harrowing, but a description of aging. Our functional lung capacity decreases. Our bowels slow down. Our glands stop functioning. Even our brains shrink. At the age of 30, the brain is a 3-pound organ that barely fits inside the skull By our 70s, gray matter loss leaves almost an inch of spare room. That's why elderly people like my grandfather are so much more prone to cerebral bleeding after a blow to the head. The brain actually rattles around inside. The earliest portions to shrink are generally the frontal lobes, which govern judgment and planning, and the hippocampus, where memory is organized. Hearing you laugh makes me think, the ways in which this is funny, although it didn't feel funny when I first read it, I have to admit. As a consequence, memory and the ability to gather and weigh multiple ideas, to multitask, peaks in midlife and then gradually declines. Oh, yes. Processing speeds start decreasing well before age 40, which may be why mathematicians and physicists commonly do their best work in their youth. By age 85, working memory and judgment are sufficiently impaired that 40% of us have textbook dementia. But I think we needed the descriptions, even the more graphic ones later on. Or did you think so?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think that one of the great strengths of this book is that you start getting into those kinds of details that people don't want to talk about. What happens when people become incontinent, or what happens when you're trying to figure out how to take care of somebody, because you're going to have a variety of issues, and almost everyone is going to face this unless they die young, and unless the people that they know die young. And even in those cases, they're not going to just flop over dead immediately. So they will go through those stages of needing care and then not recovering. So I found it, he has a kind of matter of factness, and then these little clever ways of just putting something in that is humorous. The one where he's talking about the persistent pattern of modern society. He says, the systems we've devised were almost always designed to solve some other problem. As one scholar put it, describing the history of nursing homes from the perspective of the elderly, quote, is like describing the opening of the American West from the perspective of the mules. They were certainly there, and the epochal events that were certainly critical to the mules, but hardly anyone was paying very much attention to them at the time. So he's saying, you know, we can't really view what's happening here from the perspective of the people to whom it's happening, because we don't really have access to that.
I thought he was saying that people just haven't thought about that, because the people are defined as, all of a sudden they become not people but a problem. And then we have to solve them. We have to decide what to do with them, instead of saying, last week I talked about a book called Wait, What? About life's important questions. And one of the important questions, he only had five of them, you know how those books are, but this one was pretty good. And one of them was, how can I help? And it's like nobody has done much to ask the people who wind up in nursing homes, how can I help? They've just said, oh, you are a problem, and we will deal with you in these ways. Mm-hmm. You know. Since we're starting to talk about aging, which is, as I say, the kind of the first section, he deals a lot with the whole loss of autonomy that comes with old age, or can come with old age. And he prefaces it with the story of Harry Truman, which I liked. And I always, every time I read that, I always think it's the former president. but no, it is an 83-year-old man who refused to leave his home near Mount St. Helens, even though everyone knew the volcano was about to erupt. And he just refused. He said Truman wasn't going anywhere. For more than 2 months, the volcano smoldered. Authorities extended the evacuation zone to 10 miles around the mountain. Truman stubbornly remained. He didn't believe the scientist. He was worried that his home would be vandalized. If this place is going to go, I want to go with it, because if I lost it, it would kill me in a week anyway, he said. He attracted reporters with his straight talking, curmudgeonly way, holding forth with a green John Deere cap on his head and a tall glass of bourbon and Coke in his hand. The local police thought about arresting him for his own good, but decided not to, given his age and the bad publicity they'd have to do. He told a friend, if I die tomorrow, I've had a damn good life. I've done everything I could do, and I've done everything I ever wanted to do. The blast came at 8:40 a.m. on May 18, 1980, with the force of an atomic bomb. The entire lake disappeared under the massive lava flow, burying Truman and his cats and his home with it.
And what a way to go.
Yeah.
I mean.
Unqualified admiration from you. You don't think they should have made him safe somehow?
Well, I think that's what he is kind of pointing to, that our desire to make sure that people aren't eating forbidden foods that will not be healthy for them, or they're not doing this or that, that it ends up being almost like a form of torture to spend that much energy getting people to follow the rules.
Yeah.
And it's not that we should completely abandon trying to get people to eat healthy or do take care of themselves in some way. But I think he's always pointing to the fact that people get more obsessed with that behavior than with just talking to the person about how do they feel and what would they be able to do? What would they choose? And how might they take some agency in their own well-being?
Yeah, and even, I think he even sort of says that if somebody wants, consciously wants to continue doing whatever they were doing, having a drink at night or walking around without a walker or whatever, that if that's their decision, that's their decision. There's another section in here where he talks about, let's see, it's Lou Sanders, I think, is the guy's, one of his running examples. He winds up in assisted living, which is pretty good. I mean, he's managed to... He's adjusted to where he was. He'd reassembled the pieces of a life. He's found a friend to play cribbage with. He has a routine. Some things he still liked to do. It was true he wasn't as safe as he would be in a nursing home, and his daughter is being told to put him in a nursing home because he might fall. He still feared having that big fall and no one finding him before it was too late. But he was happier, and given his druthers, he'd choose the happier place. So why choose differently? She didn't know how to answer. She found it hard to fathom any other way. He needed someone to look after him. He wasn't safe. Was she really supposed to just leave him there? And that's very, very difficult. You know, he doesn't try to make it simple. But
no,
I think
doesn't.
That would be a terribly difficult decision to make.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and the thing is, no matter how much we try to protect people from the various accidents and illnesses that they have, they're still going to have them.
Huh.
And so I think that what he focuses on is saying, maybe we need to think more about letting people be independent and letting them be in charge of their lives than trying to control and manage every detail of of their safety. I liked it. You know, in this chapter on assistance, he says, you'd think people would have rebelled. You think we would have burned the nursing homes to the ground. We haven't, though, because we find it hard to believe that anything better is possible. For when we are so weakened and frail that managing without help is no longer feasible, we haven't had the imagination for it. I'm reminded of that line in the short story To Build a Fire, that the reason he gets he dies is comes down to a failure of imagination. That he gets himself, you know, under a big branch that's got snow under it, and he falls on him and he dies. And I think that we don't use our imagination sufficiently to see that there might be a variety of ways for people to have an independent life, and it might be a little bit riskier, but that they might survive longer because they would have more of a will to live. They'd have more connections with others. And
that certainly comes up. We are, believe it or not, already up on our first break.
Get ready, Sam Marcus. 104.1 KZSM presents the second annual Sam Marcus Music Awards. Become a member today and nominate your favorite Sam Marcus music artists, venues, and more. Nominations are open till Monday, January 13th, and members-only voting is open January 15th through the 19th. Finalists will be voted on by the public January 21st through the 28th, and the Sam Marcus Music Awards ceremony will be held on January 31st at the Historic Price Center with the red carpet starting at 6 p.m. Come show your support for our local music scene as the community names this year's winners of the SMMAs. General admissions includes 5 food and drink tickets, raffles, giveaways, vendors, and VIP packages available. Sponsored by Listen Sam Marcus, The Price Center, Gumby's, Big Man Kitchen, Miracle Leaf, Kit Massage, Twin Liquors, and What's On Your Mind Design. Tickets and memberships available at kzsm.org/smma.
Let's dance into the Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Whitliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Whitliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Whitliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
All right, welcome back to Bookmarked on KZSM LP 104.1 San Marcos and KZSM.org, where we are talking about the very wonderful book, Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End by Atul Gawande. And we are talking about it with Dr. Rebecca Bell-Medero. And you said you had a quote you particularly wanted to share.
Yes, I thought this was really wonderful. And it's concerning, you know, how we make decisions for our parents, people who need to be to have some place to live. And he says, a colleague once told her, Wilson said, quote, "We want autonomy for ourselves and safety for those we love," close quote. That remains the main problem and paradox for the frail. Quote, "Many of the things that we want for those we care about are things that we would adamantly oppose for ourselves because they would infringe upon our sense of self." Mm-hmm. So it's really true that when people think about having somebody live someplace, they want to just make sure that they're not going to get hurt, mm-hmm. that they're and it's not so much, are they going to enjoy living there? Are they going to feel independent? Are they going to feel like they have a choice?
Yeah, yeah. This is kind of an aside, but a relevant point. I mean, we're sort of in the section where he is talking about aging and contrasting, and I guess we should bring this out. He talks certainly about the nursing homes and how, in general, they're pretty terrible because they're regimented and people are told, you know, what to do and when to get up and when to eat and what to eat and when to take a shower and, mm-hmm. and all of these, and it takes away people's natural autonomy. We are used to making those decisions for ourselves. You know, and then he contrasted to assisted living. I did not know that there was no official definition of assisted living until I read this. Did you?
Not really, no. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me like we haven't figured out how to look at those different gradations. And when he's talking about people who are using assisted living rather than, a supervised nursing home, mm-hmm. It is a little bit more dangerous for them. They could be out walking around and fall down. And I thought it was just kind of lovely. He says so this is the way it unfolds. In the absence of what people like my grandfather could count on, a vast extended family, constantly on hand to let him make his own choices, our elderly are left with a controlled and supervised institutional existence, a medically designed answer to unfixable problems, a life designed to be safe but empty of anything they care about.
Oh,
that just pierced my heart when I read it.
Yeah, that is truly painful. It kind of a side note that I wanted to bring up about what one cares about as one is aging, because it's something I've noticed. He says, when people reach the latter half of adulthood, their priorities change markedly. Most reduce the amount of time and effort they spend producing achievement and social networks. They narrow in. Given the choice, young people prefer meeting new people to spending time with, say, a sibling. And I should say that these conclusions come from research that he is drawing on, not just his own observation. Older people prefer the opposite. Studies find that as people grow older, they interact with fewer people and concentrate more on spending time with family and established friends. They focus on being rather than doing and on the present more than the future. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I do. I think that's very perceptive. I know that this study brings in the study of a woman who was working with people in institutions to see how happy they were.
Mm-hmm.
And she found that people who were older were, she was surprised to find them much happier and much more kind of tuned into the present, because they seem to have a sense that I don't have that much more time.
Yeah.
I had better enjoy what I'm doing now. And I found that really interesting, because she thought she was going to be just hanging around with a bunch of people who were sad and worried and everything. And she said that actually, from her experience, her peers who were younger were much less happy, much less worried about
when we're younger, we're told we're supposed to be achieving stuff, so we do, you know, right? And we keep trying. But I'll have to say, I experienced this personally, having lived for a while. small things I appreciate them, and in some cases they're enough. But there's an interesting thing that sort of a corollary, and you already articulated, but it has been supported by research, which is that the reason that older people kind of live more in the present, appreciate immediate things and simpler things more, is simply because we have a sense that we're running out of time. And that seemed to me kind of obvious. I once read a study that said that people stayed up past their bedtime because they perceived that as time that they had for themselves. And I was like, you need a study for that? You know, I mean, it seems pretty, I'm finally done with everything. I should go to bed, but now I can, you know, do whatever I like to do, play computer games or whatever. And this one, too, seemed obvious, but that she made some comparisons. Young people who have had a brush with death, for example, had the same attitudes as older people, mm-hmm. That time was short. She says, let's see, as your horizon contract, when you see the future ahead of you as finite and uncertain, your focus shifts to the here and now, to everyday pleasures and the people closer to you. Well, yeah.
Yeah. I thought one of the scenes that was the most beautiful was when he had his father come to a convocation at Ohio University. And by that time, his father was not able to walk. And he says, the ceremony was to take place in the university's basketball arena with graduates in folding chairs on the parquet and their families up in the stands. We worked out a plan to bring my father up the outside ramp by golf cart, transfer him to a wheelchair, and seat him on the periphery of the floor to watch. But when the day came and the cart brought him to the arena doors, he was adamant that he would walk and not sit in a wheelchair on the floor. I helped him to stand. He took my arm, and he began walking. I had not seen him make it farther than across a living room in half a year. But walking slowly, his feet shuffling, he went the length of the basketball floor and then up a flight of 20 concrete steps to join the families in the stands. I was almost overcome just witnessing it. Here is what a different kind of care, a different kind of medicine makes possible, I thought to myself. Here is what having a hard conversation can do. Mm. And this was preceded by them talking about, well, you know, how long do you think you're going to live? You know, and it was just this this kind of response. Yeah, I'll show you.
I cried when I read that.
I did too.
that he managed to do that. Mm-hmm. He quotes the philosopher Josiah Royce, and later he talks about one of his editors having turned him on to that early 20th century philosopher, and says what Royce seems to have observed is that people need something beyond themselves to care about. It can be something as simple as a pet or as extensive as a cause. And he has this wonderful description of a nursing home in which a kind of enlightened researcher brought in animals and plants and children. He let the people who worked there bring their children to work if they wanted to. He said people absolutely came alive. It was not as safe as it would have been. But you see people come alive. You see them begin to interact with the world, and you see them begin to love and to care and to laugh. It blows your mind. It's been an experiment in nursing homes, he says, have been an experiment in social engineering, putting our fates in the hands of people valued more for their technical prowess than for their understanding of human needs.
So. Yeah, yeah. What page is that?
I'm 128. 128. Okay.
Yeah, I thought that was particularly.
Medicine's focus. I'm just gonna keep reading, because as I say, this is how I feel about this book. Medicine's focus is narrow. Medical professionals concentrate on repair of health, not sustenance of the soul. Yet, and this is the painful paradox, we have decided that they should be the ones who largely define how we live our waning days. For more than half a century now, we have treated the trials of sickness, aging, and mortality as medical concerns. That's the experiment in social engineering.
Yeah. And he says that experiment has failed.
Yes.
If safety and protection were always sought in life, perhaps we could conclude differently. But because we seek a life of worth and purpose, and yet are routinely denied the conditions that might make it possible, there is no other way to see what modern society has done.
Oh, well, I wish it were simple to address this. Anything else about, we're going to shift to start talking about the later chapters, which talk about end-of-life decisions, mm-hmm. but anything else about the whole elder care? I mean, when he says that about assisted living, because he introduces it, and it sounds like a really great idea, the initial institutions of that, but he talks about how it got watered down, and it's not really assisted living, and it became more, because there are no standards, so you can just say, oh, hey, it's assisted living, and that's
well,
it.
And it seemed to be that once again they were more worried about whether they were going to have who knows what, a lawsuit or some kind of an issue. Was this something that people wanted?
Mm-hmm. The difficult question, which he introduces with, I would like to say, characteristic modesty, and I'm going to read again. This one's on 149. I was struck once I'd seen the transformation of elder care underway, and he's talking about how there are better alternatives now, and he has some examples of mm-hmm. places. I was struck by the simple insight on which it rested and by its profound implications for medicine, including what happens in my own office. And the insight was that as people's capacities wane, whether through age or ill health, making their lives better often requires curbing our purely medical imperatives, resisting the urge to fiddle and fix and control. It was not hard to see how important this idea could be for patients I encountered in my daily practice, people facing mortal circumstances at every phase of life. But it posed a difficult question. When should we try to fix, and when should we not? And I don't have any answers, but as you see, that's a good example of his involving the reader, because, he asked that question involves you in that question instead of, you know, sort of saying that he has answers or anything.
Well, and I think that always he returns it to asking people, what do they want? What are their goals?
Yeah.
And that, you know, the example of the woman who had cancer and was going to have a baby, and he said, so Sarah and I looked at each other, and we said, we don't have cancer on Tuesday. It's a cancer-free day. We're having a baby. It's exciting, and we're going to enjoy our baby.
Yeah.
And that is something that I think the idea of focusing more on wellness and on what people want, how do they want to live and what matters to them, is a really important part of this book.
Yeah. And on that note, we have another break, and we've got an example of kind of, and we'll come back with an example of sort of how people, about asking that question of, you know, what do you want? Because it must be, it's not easy, I would imagine, if you become debilitated or as you age, you know, what do you want? All right.
On the radio, this is the Sweet Honey Bear Blues on Tuesday at 8 o'clock till 10 o'clock. You got me giving you what you just didn't know you needed.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Whitliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Whitliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Whitliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
Welcome back to Bookmark, where we are talking with Dr. Rebecca Bell-Medero about Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. And we're talking, and he writes eloquently and very personally about people's need to decide what they want at the end of their lives. And this is a palliative care specialist dealing with her father. And I thought this was it made me think, because he's they're trying to decide whether to give him some surgery that might leave him a quadriplegic, but if he doesn't have it, he will certainly become a quadriplegic, and you know, but the surgery is risky, and they're just sort of dealing with that. Going back in was really uncomfortable, she said. It made no difference that she was an expert in end-of-life discussions. I just felt awful having the conversation with my dad. But she went through her list. She told him, I need to understand how much you're willing to go through to have a shot at being alive and what level of being alive is tolerable to you. We had this quite agonizing conversation where he said, and this totally shocked me, well, if I'm able to eat chocolate ice cream and watch football on TV, then I'm willing to stay alive. I'm willing to go through a lot of pain if I have a shot at that. I would never have expected him to say that. I mean, he's a professor. He'd never watched a football game in my conscious memory. The whole picture, it wasn't what I thought I knew.
That was another one of those things, descriptions that was very touching and very funny at the same time.
Yeah, it is funny because she's surprised that her intellectual father wants to eat, is willing to go through pain in order to be able to do those things. And there's the related question of the woman whose ovarian cancer has blocked her bowel, and he talks with her, and you wanted to cite this, about the possibilities of surgery that would at least relieve her nausea.
Well, it really deals with what are the choices involved, and so he asked her how she was doing, and she says she's doing okay. Quote, "I think I have a measure that I'm slipping. But she had been seeing old friends and relatives all day, and she loved it. It's my lifeblood, really, so I want to do it. Her family staggered the visits to keep them from tiring her out. She said she didn't like all the contraptions sticking out of her. The tubes were uncomfortable where they poked out of her belly. I didn't know that there would be this constant pressure, she said. But the first time she found that just opening a tube could take away her nausea, quote, I looked at the tube and said, thank you for being there. And it's just having that kind of humor about something that we think, well, this is really gross, but it's so touching. And then she was taking Tylenol for pain. She didn't like narcotics because they made her drowsy and weak, and that interfered with seeing people. She says, I've probably confused the hospice people because I said at some point, I don't want any discomfort, bring it on, by which she meant the narcotics, but I'm not there yet. Mm-hmm. So this idea of letting the people themselves decide when they want hospice, when they're ready to say, you don't have to do any more extraordinary procedures. Mm-hmm. I want to be comfortable, or I want to be able to eat.
Yeah. Well, that matters. I find myself thinking about these kinds of things. He talks about hospice, and again, this is one of those where we get to learn about it along with him, because he thought that it was just stop treating and doing nothing. The difference is just in the priorities. In ordinary medicine, the goal is to extend life. We'll sacrifice the quality of your existence now for a chance of gaining time later. Hospice deploys nurses, doctors, chaplains, social workers to have the fullest possible life right now. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not doing anything to ameliorate the disease, because he notices that in the conversation with the hospice worker and the patient, he says that she does, for example, take nitroglycerin for her
heart.
Yeah, for her heart, if she wants to. And so he seems to learn about hospice, which really, and I'm wondering, this book is like 10 years old, right? Something like that.
A lot of this really predicted come to be the practice. I thought it was interesting, though, he was saying that at that time there were places that had such ready assisted suicide. I thought this was an interesting statistic. The fact that by 2012, one in 35 Dutch people sought assisted suicide at their death is not a measure of success. It is a measure of failure. Yeah. Our ultimate goal, after all, is not a good death, but a good life to the very end. Mm-hmm. The Dutch have been slower than others to develop palliative care programs that might provide for it.
I thought that was, because you would kind of reading this think, oh, he's going to say assisted suicide is always good, and he certainly is not completely against it. Helping people end their misery may be necessary. Given the opportunity, I would support laws that provide these kinds of prescriptions. About half don't use them. they were so reassured just to know they have this control. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we damage entire societies if we let providing this capability divert us from improving the lives of the ill. Assisted living is far harder than assisted death, but its possibilities are far greater as well. Oh, nice sentence. Mm-hmm. It's got lots of nice sentences. How people... Oh, yes, he cites research that says that sometimes people who go into hospice actually live longer, you know, and he has that scene where the oncologist is talking to his father, and she says something like, well, you know, if you have this another round of chemotherapy, you might be playing, there's a 30% chance or something that you'll be playing tennis in and Gawande is furious. Unfortunately, his father doesn't go with that. But he's very upset. And then he cites these statistics that he asks how much more time would he really have? Mm-hmm. And she's like and that's kind of the point about that he makes with the hospice research, that sometimes people who have hospice actually live longer, and he says it's a paradox. Oh, I have to, if I can find this sentence, I have to read it. The lesson seems almost Zen. You live longer only when you stop trying to live longer. Yeah.
I thought that also he was, it was a very lovely ending to the piece, to the book, when he talks about taking his ashes of his father to the Ganges River.
I was kind of going to ask you what you thought about that, because he kind of confesses that he's an unbeliever. He says, and this is, I guess, another kind of funny line, that it's very difficult to raise someone as a devout Hindu in Ohio, He is not, in fact, a devout Hindu. But he goes with his family and he puts a portion of his father's ashes in the Ganges in an elaborate Hindu ritual. And I wondered what you thought of the fact that he does that, even though it isn't really something he believes.
Well, I thought it was psychologically such an important action. He says, "Yet I was still intensely moved and grateful to have gotten to do my part. For one, my father had wanted it, and my mother and sister did too. Moreover, although I didn't feel my dad was anywhere in that cup and a half of gray powdery ash, I felt that we connected him to something far bigger than ourselves in this place where people had been performing these rituals for so long. Mm-hmm. When I was a child, the lessons my father taught me had been about perseverance, never to accept limitations that stood in my way. As an adult, watching him in his final years, I also saw how to come to terms with limits that couldn't simply be washed or wished away."
Yeah. I think we have very little time left, but I do want to bring up, he talks about three kinds of doctors, and there's the paternalistic doctor who makes the critical choices for you. Take the red pill; it will be good for you. We might tell you about the blue pill, but then again, we might not. Then there's the informative type of doctor who will tell you facts and figures. The rest is up to you. Here's what the red pill does, and here's what the blue pill does. Which one do you want? The job of the patient is to supply the decision. This is an increasingly common way for doctors to be, and it tends to drive us to become ever more specialized. We know less and less about our patients and more about our science. And I think I see this in the doctors that I encounter who are just fine. But and he says that really what you need is an interpretive doctor who will ask questions. What is most important to you? What are your worries? Then when they know your answer, they will tell you about the blue pill and the red pill and which one would most help you achieve your priorities. And I don't know, how are we ever going to get to interpret as overworked as they often are, and as focused as he says, particularly on the technology, particularly surgeons, how are we ever going to find interpretive doctors?
Well, I think we're probably not going to do it unless we look to the example of other nations that do a better job of providing health care. My sister lives in Paris, and she and her husband get medical care that is absolutely personalized. People come to your house or apartment. The degree of care that people get, really all over Europe, in Canada, and the effects of that kind of care show that we have a terrible system. When you have this for-profit system, and when our insurance is for-profit, everything is figuring out how to make the most money rather than produce the best health effects. Yeah. And until we change that, we're really not going to be able to have decent medical results.
Were you disappointed that he didn't talk about that specifically?
No, I wasn't, because I think that would have been a different issue, and it really probably is outside of his what he's done research on. I don't think that he's tried to find where are the places that do it the best.
But certainly, you know, what would be? I mean, he's gotten to the point of talking about why in what he's calling interpretive medicine, mm-hmm. and interpretive medicine takes time, and as you say, involves the doctor spending time with the patient and actually talking to them. And you know, if we had a better system, they would have that time.
Well, they would have that time, and also if we gave different kinds of incentives. I mean, in France, doctors are required to take a month vacation. Mm-hmm. And they're paid during that time, so it's not like they have to sacrifice their livelihood. But during that time, they can travel, they can learn another language. You find doctors off with people who are learning a second language or something like that, mm-hmm. and they say, "Oh yes, I'm doing this for my month's vacation," and they're not paid excessively, but they can take as long as they want with each patient, and they just have more doctors mm-hmm. as a result. It's a profession that is it's just a better deal than what we have with our insurance system, where they have to get them in and out in 2 minutes.
Well, as you say, that's as we were saying before. I mean, that's probably for another book maybe he will address this at some point.
Yeah, I could write him a letter and say, "Hey."
Yeah. any final thoughts? We didn't say anything about the title, but I love it because it suggests a process, you know, being mm-hmm. mortal, and that's the main title, which is not necessarily informative. The subtitle is Medicine and What Matters in the End, mm-hmm. and then you know that. But so it's sort of. It sort of reflects the whole book in a way, in that it puts you in a state, doesn't say that this has to happen or that has to happen, uh-huh. but we are just all here being mortal and dealing with it. But yeah. I don't know, any thoughts about the title?
Well, I love the title because it conveys this idea that we have bodies, mm-hmm. and these bodies are going to die, and these bodies need medical care, and we need places to put these bodies, and all of these things that we try to act like we can somehow just come up with a solution that will make this easy. But it's really a process. It's being rather than just fix this and then this will work a certain way.
Yeah. Being mortal. And if you have a body, we recommend very highly that you read Atul Gawande's Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. And Rebecca Belmedro, thank you very much for coming and talking to me yet again. Start thinking about another book in a month or two.
Thank you. I will. This is so much fun, and it gets me reading and talking about wonderful books. And so it's a
me
great
too.
Program.
All right.
That's my plug for the program.
Oh, well, thank you. And as always, thank you for listening.